Shrink Wrap Radio number 343, The Marriage of Tarot and Psychology, with Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone, both of whom are longtime students of esoteric wisdom and teachers of the Tarot, and we'll be discussing ways in which Tarot and psychology support one another. Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone are co-founders of the Tarot School, created in New York City in 1995. Pillars of the modern Tarot movement, Ruth Ann and Wald teach, write, speak, and publish about Tarot on every conceivable level: divination, psychology, esotericism, and magical practice are all areas of expertise covered by this pioneering Tarot couple. Ruth Ann and Wald's unique wisdom unfolds as they develop new Tarot techniques and innovative classes, inspiring students on a global level. Yet they remain lifelong Tarot students. Their Tarot School's correspondence course and various audio courses are perennial favorites among the international Tarot community. Their live Monday night Manhattan classes cater to the city's brightest esoterically minded students. The Amberstones are authors of The Secret Language of Tarot, Tarot Tips, 78 Practical Techniques to Enhance Your Tarot Reading Skills, and contributors to Cairo Manchetti's Legacy of the Divine Tarot, and Llewellyn's Tarot Reader Almanacs. Schiffer Books has recently published The High Deck, a symbolic deck of cards created by Wald's father, Arthur Amberstone. They put on a conference every year, including an upcoming one this April of 2013, which we will discuss in some detail on the show. So, here's the interview. Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yes, well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. We've been communicating via phone and email about some upcoming events that we'll talk about further down the line, but I really welcome this opportunity to explore the wonderful world of Tarot with you and its intersection with psychology. Now, you both have a long history with the Tarot. Did you discover it separately or together?
Well, definitely separately, since we didn't know each other for a good part of our lives.
Uh-huh.
So, well, actually, I shouldn't say definitely, because there are people who come to it after they've met. But no, both of us had been involved with it for quite some time before we met each other.
Okay. Well, let's see. There are two good stories there. Just quickly, Ruth Ann, since you've got the ball here, how did you two meet?
Well, we met at a summer solstice ritual. There was a group in New York City that did rituals on the solstices and the equinoxes and full moons and such. And it was like a networking organization, and people from the city would get together and celebrate the holidays. And so there were always different people coming and going, and we just happened to intersect at that particular one.
Okay, so clearly you both were already involved in esoteric things, and that brought you together. I'd like to hear about what I would call, drawing upon Joseph Campbell, your call to the Tarot. You know, Campbell talks about getting the call, and not everybody's drawn to the Tarot. It's kind of a select group. Wald, let me put that ball in your court. Tell us about your call to the Tarot.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I grew up in a family where symbolism and games were both important things. My father was a game inventor. And the
interesting.
Kind of invented, yeah. He actually was a creator in a medium of game and play. And he created many board and card games that were all symbolic in nature. They were physically beautiful to look at, very aesthetic. And they played in such a way as to in some way engage the philosophical and spiritual side of a person. And surprisingly, everybody turns out to be a philosopher when you push the right buttons. I don't know how that happened, but it seems to be the case. And so I grew up with that, and I began to see the world that way from a very early time. And I would see everything in terms of games and play. Such things as law courts and churches and synagogues and school and things like that, all of those were understood to be playgrounds with specialized rules that obtained entirely within the grounds of that particular organization, where you did certain very ritualized things in order to accomplish certain very specialized tasks. And all of that was seen and understood by me through the kind of instruction I got from my father as being essentially playful.
Was your father into the Tarot?
No, actually, he wasn't. We're talking now about the late 50s, early 60s, let's say. And at that time, tarot was almost impossible to find. The only people who knew about it were people in esoteric orders. I mean, the Freemasons and the Golden Dawn and the OTO and BOTA, those are names that many people may not know about. And many people did not know about it at that time. It was really hidden. People were much more interested in simply getting along.
Well, tell us, at what point did you discover the Tarot?
It was in 1959 that I discovered the Tarot, and I found it in a store, in one of those first head shops, one of the first of the New Age, universe mm-hmm. that came out.
Wow.
I was wandering around in there out of curiosity, and I saw it. And at that time, the only deck that was available that I know of, anyway, was the Marseille deck, which is basically a 17th century deck that managed to survive all those years. And I was fascinated as soon as I saw it. And I recognized a symbolic game that had obviously predated me and my interest by, several centuries. I didn't know that such a thing existed. And
well,
I it and took it and ran with it.
Yeah, I suppose I discovered it probably in a similar way. I hadn't thought of the term head shop even in quite a long time, but
I know.
Sometime in the early to mid 60s in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that must be about the time that I came upon the Tarot when, the whole 60s thing was starting to happen and head shops were around and we were all discovering lots of interesting new things. Ruth Ann, tell us about your call to the Tarot or when or how you discovered it and how it spoke to you.
Well, how I discovered it. I know my mother had bought me a couple of decks and I probably had talk to her about it because I can't imagine it's the type of thing that she would have just done spontaneously on her own. But I just wanted to mention that the first deck that I purchased for myself, which was a decision, in other words, I looked around and I chose a deck, also got at a head shop. And this was a little bit later. It was probably in the early 70s. And I remember that Donovan was playing over the, in the music. And it was wonderful, the smells and the colors, and I bought an Aquarian tarot, which was also very colorful.
Yeah.
So, but I had been very interested in all kinds of mystical things in general, and it was at the very, very beginning of what's considered the New Age movement. There was a conference, I suppose, not too far from where I lived, and I had already started college at that point. I was driving, and so it was, easy for me to get to, and it was like a 5-day conference where they had everything. I mean, everything, and it was like such an incredible feast. I'd be there early in the morning, and I'd stay till late and took classes in every imaginable thing. So it was shortly after that that I settled. I knew I wanted to pick something. I didn't want to be scattered, with my interests. I wanted to focus on something. And I considered astrology because I had a friend who was an astrologer, but I'm not really that type of a thinker. Numbers aren't particularly my thing. And back then, they did not have computer programs that would do the chart for
right,
you.
Right.
You had to do the math yourself.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I did it once to prove that I could, but it was really difficult and not a lot of fun. I liked interpreting more than, you know, doing that type of thing. And another friend told me, she gave me my first tarot reading, and she said, you should do tarot. And I thought, And never looked back from that point.
Wow. Well, so did you both grow up in New York City then?
Well, I grew up in New York, and, well, you started growing up
in
New York. But
I was born in New York, and then early on in my life, I was like 2 years old or something, my parents moved to California, and I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area until I was about 13 or 14, and then moved back to New York, where I've been pretty much ever since.
Okay.
I'm a New Yorker transposed to California and then back to New York. I was like a potted plant that was moved from one flower pot to another, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that you choose the plant metaphor, because I was going to say something about getting pollinated.
So I've got a little California in me and a lot of New York.
Yeah. I'm sort of picturing two young people maybe hanging around the village, and both with very interesting childhoods and sets of parents, it sounds like. Was there ever a time when you thought you were going to grow up to be something else, you know, like a dentist or a hairdresser or
I majored in theater, and I was also a songwriter talking about the village. I spent a lot of time in Greenwich Village, part of the singer-songwriter movement.
All right.
And a lot of now famous people came out of that time.
Sure.
You know, names that you would recognize. And I really had every intention of following that path. Although at school I was also, you know, taking classes, and as my mother would say, something to fall back on. So I wound up going into publishing, which at the time I thought was really a dreadful experience. But later in life, as a business owner, you discover that everything you ever learned, you use.
Exactly. So I've said that more times. You're the only other person I've heard say that.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, all the stuff that I learned working in an office and all these skills that I picked up there, I use every single day.
Exactly.
I
totally understand that. How about you, Wald? Did you ever think you were going to grow up to be a fireman?
It's really very funny. That would have been the absolute last thing on my mind. When I started out, in those days, early on, getting a job was pretty easy. There was no online universe at all. And I could get a job in the morning by simply showing up at a door and knocking on it and saying, I'm looking for a job. And they said, what can you do? And I'd give them some kind of an answer. And they'd hire me because I looked like a competent young person. And by the afternoon, I'd had enough of that job. So I'd quit, and by the evening I'd get another job. And so I would sometimes have as many as 3 jobs in one day. So my career was more than checkered. It was spectacular.
Boy, that's a very different economic environment than young people find themselves in.
Yeah, you couldn't do that now, of course.
No.
But at that time I did, and I found it really exhilarating and fun. I had very few real needs. And in those days, you could get in a whole 3-room apartment in the village for $60 a month.
Wow.
And so I managed to do very nicely. And my personal interests, the things that made life worthwhile, were completely separated from what was needed to survive. Economics and what really mattered to me were totally separated from each other. I didn't have the slightest interest in a career, the usual kinds of things that make a career, that is some choice of profession that you would want to follow and the specialized skills and education you would need to get that. I was completely uninterested in what mattered to me, were things that I could uncover and understand for myself. So
yeah,
I was basically a traveling philosopher, you know, from the time I was 10 years old.
Wow. And that's a good recipe for you know, that's, I guess that's always been a good recipe, to follow your heart. It takes some courage to do that, and I think you both did that, and you went on to develop a livelihood around teaching others about the tarot, and I think also publishing around that. So tell us a little bit about that, and what is it about the tarot that, this is a very compound question here, what is it about the tarot that attracted you in the first place, and what is it about the tarot that keeps you sticking to it all these many years later?
Well, what attracted me in the first place, it was part of that soup of mystical, magical things that mm-hmm. I was always attracted to. But there are a couple of things that have kept my interest, and one of them is that it's an evolving form, and it's always new, and there are always things to discover about it. So you can go backward in time to discover things about it, and you can create your own forms, and there's a lot of creativity in terms of technique and art, and it's just a very vibrant form. And personally, the two of us have spent a lot of time developing rather intricate techniques that we use all the time that fascinate me and just, you know, keep me involved.
Yeah.
And we're always thinking of new ways to apply things and then new discoveries that will come up. And so I guess that's the basic answer.
Okay, good. Walt, what's your take on that?
Well, to make a long story short, I discovered with tarot early on that it was, at least for me, a language.
Hmm.
It's cards and the symbols in each card were both highly organized and very deep. And I found that, like with any language, you could learn to speak it, think it, read it, feel it, to communicate in it. I found that it was extremely malleable without losing its shape or its substance. And I found that it gave me the means to organize a whole lifetime's worth of somewhat chaotic thought. It gave me the means to penetrate deeply into my own understanding of myself and the world around me. You know how when you learn, when you're a little kid and you go to school and they teach you the ABCs? You know, they teach you to sing the little alphabet song so you remember your alphabet. And then they teach you how to add. They teach you 1 + 1 = 2. And that first statement, 1 + 1 = 2, the amount of philosophical and spiritual experience that comes from that one statement, 1 + 1 = 2, there's so much embedded in that, that once you learn that, even though you don't know what you're doing, you have already been inducted into a whole civilized way of being. You know, it's really hard to imagine how powerful those first classes, those first learning experiences are when you're a little kid. You're inducted into a whole way of thinking, doing, and feeling that is unique to your particular time and place. What they teach you in school is very, very much contemporary. What they taught in school in the 1880s is not the same thing they're teaching in school now. I'm pretty sure of that. And what you're taught in school now allows you to take part in the world that you're a part of. But what I learned from tarot was something that was pretty old. I learned something that was ancient. I learned a style of thinking and a style of doing and a style of organizing my thoughts and my life that came from something that was as close to timeless as I could get.
Hmm. That's really fascinating. It gives a fascinating feel for it. I know that as I began to look into tarot, I discovered that there's a whole realm of historical scholarship and that there are, you know, relatively recent discoveries and their debates about the history and so on. And I think initially I had been told that, just something, you know, simple, like, oh, the tarot goes back to the ancient Egyptians or something like that, and just kind of left it there. But it turns out it's got the past is somewhat shrouded in mystery and so on. Maybe you can give us just a bit of an overview of the history of the tarot as far as we know about it.
Well, it's a complex subject by this time.
Sure.
There is a, a recent, relatively recent, 10 years, 15 years maybe, of extreme interest in the history of tarot by those people who find tarot fascinating. And that amounts to millions of people at this point. So there has been a considerable amount of scholarship over these years, and I have not paid careful attention to that scholarship. So what I'm saying here is going to be only very broadly true, and the specifics of it are something that somebody would have to follow out on their own. But given that limitation, I can tell you that it has been discovered and documented that tarot makes its first appearance on the world scene in northern Italy somewhere in the middle of the 15th century. There are some antecedents. There are some playing card decks that come out a little earlier than that. They come from different sources, but the idea that it was an ancient Egyptian artifact is basically mythology. It actually has its historical beginnings in 15th century Italy. And then from there, it went through a series of stages. To begin with, it was widely accepted and widely used as a game. It was a game like you would play bridge now. In fact, the use of tarot to play card games was actually the, as far as I understand it, the origin of bridge and the idea of trumps as being a part of the trick-taking universe of card games.
Mm-hmm.
So it started off that way, and it was very popular, and it spread across Europe in that particular way. And it tended to be, as far as I know, the occupation of the upper classes. It was, you know, something very popular at court.
Okay,
and
well,
a lot of courts.
Yeah, then, let me interrupt here to ask you something then, because earlier you said it taught you a timeless, ancient way of thinking, of viewing the world, of understanding yourself. So we have that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the relatively recent discovery that its origins are maybe, you know, somewhere in the 15th century, as you suggest.
Mm-hmm.
So how do those two articulate with each other? Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, where is it that that older way of thinking comes in?
Actually, the older way of thinking comes in a little bit later. For the first part of its history, tarot was a game, and it was used, of course, for divination and fortune-telling for a long time. At a certain point, the European esoteric community discovered that tarot was useful to them and expressed in its structure things that were useful to express. It became, in fact, a universal symbolic language that allowed astrologers, numerologists, Kabbalists, Christian esotericists, and a variety of other
things. Yeah, alchemists, Freemasons.
Exactly. All of those people actually found that tarot was a useful way of expressing their particular disciplines. And normally speaking, they didn't have much of a way to communicate with each other. They were really different fields, and very much the same way that the sciences are different sciences. And you can be a biologist and not be able to speak very well to a physicist. They're simply different disciplines. Well, they found that tarot was actually a way that they could express a simple, single conception of the universe as essentially a magical place, a magical and spiritual place. And magical spirituality was the essence of esotericism, and Europe was filled with it. The whole intelligentsia of Europe was loaded down with the symbolism and intent of esoteric matters. Once they applied it to tarot, which happened at the end, really in a big way, happened from the end of the 18th century onwards, from around the time of the French Revolution forward. Once esotericism and tarot were joined together, then tarot began to express in its symbolism the entire wealth of European esotericism, which goes back a long, long way. So tarot actually acquired its depth, its power, its ancientness, its philosophical capacity by way of a connection with that community, which had existed and pre-existed, you know, tarot, and was actually probably had a lineage going back as far as you can go. I think the human race has always been interested in those things, and it's been cumulative, so that the esoteric community of Europe took a lot, borrowed a lot, from the esoteric universes of Greece and Egypt, and that all turned into a kind of stone soup.
Just yeah, we haven't mentioned Kabbalah as you were
Well, Kabbalah was actually mm-hmm. the... I'm sorry I didn't mention Kabbalah,
yeah.
That's my primary interest. Kabbalah is essentially a form of specifically Jewish mysticism. And because it is highly, because it has a highly organized, philosophical content, it became actually the foundation, the blueprint for esoteric work in Europe in general. Whether you were an alchemist or a Christian, esotericist, people tended to use Kabbalah as a way of organizing the esoteric practice. It wasn't only a matter of knowledge and thought, it was also a matter of magical practice and philosophical practice. So Kabbalah became the organizing principle, and from my point of view, alchemy became the engine.
Mm-hmm.
So one was the principle and one was the engine, and the two of them together, both alchemy and Kabbalah, when they joined and blended, produced a very, very heady philosophical and magical mixture. What's funny about that is that here we are at the tail end of the, of the movement that brought psychology into tarot, and in very much the same way that esotericism was added on and then became wedded to and pretty much identical to tarot, psychology has had that same experience with tarot in the last 50, 60 years. Once Jung became very popular and tarot became popular pretty much at the same time, in that period of time when you and I both discovered it in the 60s and 70s,
yep,
all of a sudden everybody began to see tarot as archetypes.
Yes.
And that word was not used about tarot earlier. The archetype, the idea of archetype came into play in the popular mind with Jung. And Jung didn't become popular until the 60s.
Right.
He'd written a long time ago. So in the meantime, tarot has learned to carry, to express, and to further the work of symbolic psychology.
And indeed.
So now it has all of that too.
Yeah, indeed. And that's, if anybody's wondering why I have these two people on the show, what's the relationship to psychology? You just put your finger on it. Some years ago, I was conducting a workshop in Ireland and planned to use an exercise that involved tarot cards because I have found them to be an excellent projective device. You talked about them carrying meanings for us, and they're just so wonderfully evocative. Well, some of my Irish hosts were just shocked, and they regarded the cards as essentially evil. They associated them, I guess, with carnivals run by gypsies who they saw as, being about theft and so on. So, indeed, some of my listeners to the show might even be shocked that I'm devoting earnest conversation to this topic. What are some of the myths, or in the sense of erroneous ideas, that surround tarot?
Well, you know what? It isn't really a matter of erroneous. It's more a matter of style and personal predilection. There are, as you probably know, in this country, and certainly there are in other places, vestiges, pockets of population who regard the automobile as evil and who still insist on going from place to place with horse and carriage.
That's
true. There are communities of people who still regard the old ways of both philosophical and spiritual doing as being the only true ways. There are whole, areas of the world that are heavily influenced by spiritual orthodoxies that come from a couple of thousand years ago. The mindset comes from those days, and those people honor those mindsets. So if it says something in the Bible or the Quran or the Confucian Analects or whatever it happens to be that you that's your particular spirituality, and if you observe those things literally, as people often do, then you're going to find ample reason to take something like tarot and say it's evil. Evil is simply a word that is coined by and used by people who have that particular long-ago mindset, and they bring it into the modern world and insist that the world basically observe their principles. They feel very strongly. It's not that it's wrong, and it's not that it's erroneous or that it is silly or foolish. It's just that it's their way of thinking. And their way of thinking oftentimes conflicts with the world as we see it, as most people see it. It's not a a majority viewpoint anymore.
Well, I think there's some ignorance involved in that, too. I
mean, well, that's what we say.
Right. From our point of view, it is a matter of ignorance. And when you had mentioned earlier, and this is something that's been very prevalent for a long time, the story that that Tarot came out of Egypt.
Yes.
If it's a sound bite. Okay, so if you had only heard that and you didn't take the time to learn more about it, your understanding would be that it was Egyptian. And let's say you had a prejudice against Egypt for some reason. Suddenly, it would be a negative thing.
Well, anyway, the point is that there is a lot of ways of thinking about the world. I am not inclined to regard ways of thinking as being either erroneous, evil, ignorant, or other things. They're just simply different ways of thinking. And since the scientific approach to the world is now the current orthodoxy, I would bet you that the Jungian society in New York City would find tarot almost as objectionable as the fundamentalist Christians.
I'm not sure. You might be right. I have no idea, even though I've been interviewing a ton of Jungians lately. From your insider point of view, what's your understanding of what the Tarot can accomplish for individuals? I mean, you run a school. You're teaching people to use it. What's your understanding of the value, of the personal value for people?
The main thing that is important to me and that I see with our students and with other people that I know who have worked with Tarot is that it really helps to understand yourself, your world, how you interact, and the people around you. So, well, I think that one of the ways that people get in trouble a lot is making assumptions, and it's totally subconscious, that, you know, if you see the world a certain way or you feel a certain way, that's the way it is. And when somebody acts in a way that's different, there's a conflict that happens. And Tarot is the language that explains why that person is different and how it sort of gives you a glimpse of the world through their eyes so that you can see that they're just experiencing things in their own way. And it does give some real explanation as to how that happens. So it can take conflict out of relationships, blame out of relationships. It's a huge thing for that. Personally, it helped me understand the dynamic between my parents. And that was something that always puzzled me. I just didn't understand. I mean, they've been together. They're about to celebrate, I think, their 65th anniversary or something like that. And they would always, you know, argue. And I couldn't understand why they were still together. And then through our explorations of Tarot, I understood the dynamics and where they were strong together and where they had difficulties, but that those difficulties were just stylistic and that it didn't even really impact their relationship that much. And being able to see things like that.
Ruth Ann, yes. You were just telling us about the value that Tarot has played in your own life as, kind of relates very much, I think, to the Jungian idea of typology as a way of helping us to get out of the blame game and see that, we come from different ways of seeing the world. I wanted to ask you guys, what is your theory, if you will, of how the Tarot works?
Ah, well, that's simple enough.
Really?
It's actually awfully simple. It's really not hard at all.
Okay.
Let's assume for the moment, and we have to make assumptions here because there's no other way. Let's assume for the moment that tarot is indeed archetypal, that the imagery, the actual physical imagery on the cards is evocative. Somebody who doesn't know anything about tarot can look at a picture of death or a picture of the devil or a picture of lovers, and they were going to see things in those pictures that everybody would see. They are archetypal in the sense that they are universal human responses to pictures.
Yes.
They're universal because they're there. They're something that can be found in everybody. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a Japanese or an Eskimo. You're going to recognize a father figure and a mother figure when you see one. And even if your personal experience and your cultural experiences are different, having a father and having a mother and having a lover and having death in your life are going to be present no matter what. And since tarot is built on imagery and names and relationships like that, they tend to be there for everyone, pretty much on demand. Learning how to manipulate those things and to get the most information from them is a matter of skill and experience, but simply being aware of them and responding to them is pretty universal. So what happens is that every single card in the deck has been so carefully developed and scrutinized over time that every single one of them can be said to be working inside of you in some function or another. Every card, as an archetypal experience, is going to be in you, working as you, one way or another, either in strength or in weakness, either in help or in harm. One way or another, they're there. So when you work with tarot and the cards come up, however you use them, and there are very specific ways of using them to accomplish different purposes, the cards are going to speak not only to you, they're going to speak as you. They're going to speak through you.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways that those archetypal forms can actually come to the surface in your own words and in your own thoughts and in your own activities. And they can be seen, they can be spoken about, they can be understood, and from that point of view, unconscious material comes to the surface almost instantaneously.
Okay, what about the role of synchronicity?
Well, synchronicity is a particularly and specifically Jungian concept, is it not?
Yes.
And as far as I understood, it simply applies to the idea that two apparently separate happenings or events can be joined together in a meaningful connection by the person for whom the two events mean something. Two people looking at the same two events might not have the same reaction to them. So let's say, for example, that you're crossing the street and a dead pigeon falls at your feet. Well, for me, it would just be a dead pigeon falling on my feet, just a peculiarity that, oh my God, a pigeon died and dropped right here. It doesn't mean anything more to me than that. But for you, if a pigeon has symbolic, you know, significance, if you're, let's say, a person for whom a dove, which is a version of a pigeon, you know, is a significant spiritual symbol, a dove falling at your feet, dead at your feet, might have all kinds of disastrous consequences for your psyche. So it's only the fact that a person applies meaning from their own experience to the world around them that gives those things, in fact, meaning. I think synchronicity is nothing more than that, the application of your personal brand of meaning to the otherwise random events of the world. I don't think, in fact, you can have meaning for anything. I don't think there's anything at all that means anything unless you make it mean that.
Okay, well, you don't sound as woo-woo as a lot of people would expect you to sound.
Why do you think somebody would expect me to sound woo-woo? Did you expect me to sound woo-woo?
No, I didn't, based on our earlier conversations, but you never know. You know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you to comment on, but I think it's kind of already been interwoven in some of your responses, is what you see as the relationship between psychology and the tarot and where you see it going in the future.
Well, you know, because there is, as simply a fact of life, a built-in prejudice against, well, prejudice is automatic. Prejudice is built in, I guess. The nature of prejudice is to be built in. Prejudice simply means prejudging. That is, you have an automatic, instantaneous, and prearranged response to the world as it comes at you, and the prejudice could either be in favor of or against whatever it is that comes to you. And tarot is certainly on the receiving end of a good deal of prejudice. But the antidote to prejudice is awareness, is knowledge. There is so much to know here. And the reason that we're having this conversation is because it is my pleasure, my preference, to bring the professional knowledge and value of the psychological community, which is colossal, colossal amount of knowledge that you guys have, to the into the service of the tarot community. The tarot community as a whole is actually has been extremely affected by what psychologists have done, and they are beginning to apply what they know or what they've heard or what they suspect of psychological practice to their practice of tarot, but they're doing it without knowing how. And my desire is to make the relationship between tarot and psychology, which has actually existed de facto for 50 years, become more formal. You guys have an awful lot to teach us, an awful lot. But the interesting thing is that we have a lot to teach you as well. That's we know that you have stuff to teach us, but you guys don't know what we have to teach you. And it's a very, it could be a very fruitful confluence. And so we're trying to make that happen. And I know it'll take time, and it will only affect a few people. And the scientific orthodoxy is every bit as orthodox as any religious orthodoxy. And there will always be people who reject it and regard it as woo-woo because they're prejudiced in that direction. They have a predilection to think that way, and the chances are you'll never get them to change their mind, nor is it necessary. But there are some people who are open to this idea, and for those people, this can be an extremely valuable get-together.
Well, yeah, you're saying your get-together actually is a good lead-in to invite you to tell us about the conference that you have going on in April. I gather you have an annual conference, and this year there's so you can tell us about that, and then you're doing something special kind of as a pre-conference conference.
Yes, we have an annual conference, which is normally a three-day conference over a weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, every year at the end of April. And it's a professional tarot readers conference. Basically, it is a place where the best teachers in the world bring together a very strong audience of competent readers and teaches them new practical technique to raise the bar of their actual professional practice. And it has been going on now for this coming year will be our 11th year in a row that we've done this. The audience has grown, our reputation has grown because we do extremely good work. And as I said, tarot has had an inclination towards psychology for some time, and it occurred to me, we have always done a kind of pre-conference class on Thursday afternoons. Ruth Ann and I will teach a master class on Thursday afternoons for those people who come into the conference a day early. And this year we decided that we would take that day, that Thursday, and we would devote it to a conference entirely connected to and concerned with and expressing the relationship between tarot and psychology. So we called it a tarot and psychology conference. And so we're doing a whole day of presentations by people who are PhD psychologists with 30 or more years of practice who all use tarot in their practice. They don't have to be convinced. They're already doing it. And they know how to do it. They know how to make those two disciplines work together. And they know the value of those disciplines, of the two disciplines when they're working together. And they can express those things. They can teach the tarot community what they know. And they can also teach those psychologists who are curious and interested what bearing tarot might have on their psychological practice. They know the value of the two things working together. So we have a whole full day conference now for the first time that's called Tarot and Psychology. And so it'll be a level meeting ground, a place where psychologists can sort of come out of the closet and allow for their interest in tarot, which maybe professionally might be difficult for them otherwise. Here's a place where they can freely admit that they're doing this and actually get a great deal of pleasure from it. And it's also a place where people who have heard about it and might be somewhat curious about it can leave the ivory tower of academe and enter another world altogether and find it as fascinating as I'm sure they're going to do. So our tarot conference will be connected with that. We'll have a total of 4 days of involvement together. It is acceptable to us for people who are interested in tarot and psychology specifically to come to that as a one-day event. And they can pay for it as a one-day event and just show up for that. If they wish, they can join us for the entire 4 days and have the benefit of a really fabulous social occasion as well as a learning occasion. And then we hope to make this a regular feature of our conference every year. I'd like to work with tarot and psychology for a long time to come, because I think that there's an enormous amount to explore, and there's a lot of people who are capable of helping us do that. So I'm looking forward to this as the first step along a long road.
Well, I will be putting a link to your, I'll put your website address in the show notes for the show, and so people will be able to see that in the show notes, and that will link, they'll find links to the conference and to the dates in April. I think the psychology and tarot day, is that April 24th? Am I remembering correctly?
25th.
Okay,
24th. Thursday, April 25th.
Yeah, the 24th is the day I fly, so that's why
that's
it's sticking
right
in my mind.
Did you tell people that you are going to be one of those wonderful presenters?
I think I hinted as much. I think I said I'm going to be one of three keynote presenters, and
that's
I'm going
right
to be.
By the way, for those people who don't know this, one of the reasons that we ended up doing this together is because when we were looking around for people who had who could do what we wanted them to do, we needed people who really had credentials in both fields. And one of the things that was so funny, Ruthann and I just basically cracked up when we read your resume, when we were first, you know, making your acquaintance, and we went and hunted you down, so to speak, and looked, you know, Googled you and looked you up. Your resume made us look like slackers.
Are you kidding?
The list of your accomplishments and what you had done over time was so enormous, and it's really a beautiful piece of work. So
thank
I just
you
wanted people to know that, you know, that's why we've become friends in the meantime, but I think that was just so funny. It was, nobody in tarot has a resume like, except in their own field, but I mean, in terms of academic accomplishment, yours is enormous and amazing and should hold the attention and get the respect of everybody who's going to come.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, in my presentation, one of the things I'm going to be doing, you know, I have a long-standing interest, is if you look over at all these interviews that I've done, you know, there's certain themes that pop up, and certainly there's a very strong Jungian thread. There's a very strong interest in dreams historically, and also not so much in the interviews, but historically in my own development, an interest in hypnosis, which goes all the way back to my doctoral dissertation. So as part of my keynote presentation, I'll be doing a hypnotic induction with the audience and suggesting that they have a dream, and then they'll be working in small groups to use the tarot to help each person in their small group to explore or expand on the meaning of that dream. So I thought we might give our listeners a taste of that here, and we'll skip the hypnosis part. But I thought I would. And anybody in the audience, wake up now.
Right. I'll count to three and snap my fingers, and you'll be fresh and as a daisy, and you won't remember a thing, right?
Yeah, right. Except what a wonderful time you've had listening to us here. So we'll skip the hypnosis part, but I thought I would share with you an image from a dream from two nights ago, night before last, and suggest that you then draw one or two or three cards at random and see what they might have to say about me and my dream image. Is there some way that that could fit within your theory of using the tarot?
Sure. Yeah, we can give it a try. Let me grab a deck. Hang on
okay
a second. You guys talk amongst yourselves. I'll be right back.
Okay, well, I actually recorded
the dream.
I'll tell
you something interesting about that, by the way. There are two primary ways of using tarot in practice. One is to work with a shuffle deck and to extract from that deck at random cards that will have a synchronous connection with mm-hmm the top hand, and it works very, very well. The extent to which it works depends to some extent on the skill and the insight of the practitioner. There are, however, other ways of doing it which do not involve random selection, but involve very specific techniques that allow you to choose the aspects of tarot that are appropriate to the situation, in which case you're dealing with something as precise and as scientific as any scalpel.
Hmm.
And so that's something that I prefer. I like, but I'm not as comfortable with the random as other people are. I like precision.
Well,
other people actually prefer the random. So there are two different approaches. So Ruth Ann will do one and I'll do the other.
Yeah, good, because it'd be interesting to hear what the non-random approach is and the, uh-huh. the random and see where we go. And I'm not going to burden you with a long, elaborate dream account. I was blessed with just a very interesting little short snippet, as I say, just the night before last. And so now I'm bringing up my journal on my computer here in front of me. So here it comes. You ready?
Yep.
I always like to title my dreams. So the title of this dream is A Bunny Brings Something Buried. I'm in the backyard, and I have a fleeting image of a bunny bringing me something it has dug up. The bunny is a dirty color, not all fluffy and white and clean looking, probably because it has been digging in the adobe in our backyard. So the bunny's kind of dirty looking, and now it's reminding me of one of my children's stuffed bunnies from long ago that got very old and beat up looking over the years. The bunny has dug up something, I'm not sure what, because what it's dug up is also dirty. It has a strange lumpy shape. I think it might have been wrapped in bandaging, in the kind of tape, the white tape that they use for a bandage. And that's it.
Okay. Ruth Ann, you want to go first?
Well, okay. I have one question, I suppose. Are you
sure.
more interested in the bunny as the symbol, or do you want to know what it is that the bunny dug up?
Well, those are both very interesting questions. I think that the one that might be easier for us to explore here would probably be the bunny as a symbol, since it does fit, you know, into the symbolic realm so well. The mystery gift, of course, is very interesting, and consciously, I don't know what that gift is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I know we talked about me doing a random draw, but I'm actually not going to do a random draw, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
There happens to be one card that features a bunny, just the color that you described, digging in the dirt, and that's the Queen of Pentacles.
Okay.
So it's that symbol from your dream is right there. And so that would lead me to look at the Queen of Pentacles to give you a message.
Yes, go ahead and do that. And I'm going to be looking for the Queen of Pentacles. I've got a deck here in front of me.
By the way, you have to realize that there are 3,000 or 4,000 decks out there, and they're all different by virtue of the pictures that they show.
Right.
So we're working with the weight deck at this point.
Yes,
right.
Thank
so
you.
So, of course, not every Queen of Pentacles is going to have a bunny, and certainly not necessarily a brownish bunny, and it's especially not necessarily a brownish bunny that appears to be digging in the dirt. So
it's in the universal weight deck. It's probably in the...
So you were talking about synchronicity before, and that's quite a synchronicity, I think.
Yeah.
So let me know when you found it.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to both be present with you guys and to give these 78 cards. I probably should have arranged them in some kind of order.
Oh, yeah. When we teach, I have a separate deck that's in order.
Uh-huh.
So when people, you know, draw cards and we talk about a particular spread, I can pull those cards really quickly.
Oh, I found the Queen of Pentacles, but I'm not seeing that image on my version.
If you look at the lower right-hand corner.
What kind of deck do you have?
It's a Rider Waite, but it may not be the same one that you have.
It should have the bunny in the corner, in the lower right-hand corner of the Queen of Pentacles.
Oh, wait, yeah, it blends in. You have to look very closely because
okay,
it's
so you have
the same
a, you have
color. Yeah, it's the same color as the Earth.
Okay. We use the Universal Waite deck, which was recolored with colored pencils, and it's much easier to see the symbolism, which is why we like it.
Also, turning on the light, turning on another light,
you know, that
helps
would probably
a lot.
Help, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That, by the way, there alone is a symbolic act.
Turning on the light.
Duh. Okay, let's get into
anyway,
it.
Anyway, so here you are in this really lush environment, and of course most people are not going to be familiar with the card, so I'll describe it a little bit. But it's an outdoor scene, and which explains the bunny in the dirt. But the main figure is the Queen of Pentacles. She's seated on a rather ornately carved stone throne, which has pears and angels and goat heads, which, because she's associated with the sign of Capricorn, and so that's why that's there. And she is dressed in a robe of red, like a red kind of pinafore thing over a white undergarment, and she has a long green veil going down her back, sort of like a shawl, and a little crown on top of her head. And she's holding a pentacle with a golden disc with a five-pointed star in the center in her lap, which she's just sort of gazing at, you know, in a contemplative kind of manner.
And let me just insert one quick comment here, is that any listener can look this card up, can Google the card, and they'll see a picture of it very quickly.
Yeah, that's a good idea, sure. Mm-hmm. And so she's, you know, in an outdoor scene, and there are mountains in the background and flowers, like she's under an arbor with leaves and what appear to be roses or some kind of pink flower. And she's, the thing that's striking me about this for you, and this is a technique that we use a lot, where an image will draw your attention, and then that image will sort of be the jumping off point for a message or an understanding.
Okay.
And so you can look at the same card dozens of times and get something different from it each time.
Oh, definitely.
So we're talking together and I'm connecting with you right now. And so the thing that is drawing my attention most at the moment is the stone throne. And yet she is apparently very comfortable. You know, you would think that if you were sitting on a chair made out of rock, that it would be like, oh, I can't wait to get off of this thing. But she's just sort of, you know, very cozy, hanging out. And what I'm getting from this, because she is contemplating the pentacle, is that her, meaning your inner life, is very rich and comfortable, and so it doesn't really matter what's going on around you. You still always have that. You can always go there. And connecting with your inner sense will give you a sense of comfort, even if you're in an uncomfortable situation.
And as I hear you speak and pointing out that this is a stone chair, which I had never thought about before, it suggests to me a firm base. It suggests to me resting in a kind of firm, maybe confident, which I don't experience myself always as terribly confident or firmly established, but this inner feminine presence is firmly established.
Yes, and she's a queen, so she has rank and she has experience and she is firmly established. And also Pentacles is an earth suit, so it's very grounded. And just getting back to the bunny, in case anybody's saying, but you're not talking about the bunny.
Yeah, I was just going to say that too. Go ahead.
Okay, I used the bunny as a sort of a secret path, something that I call. So in other words, you mentioned the symbol, and I found where that symbol led. So it's not necessarily about the rabbit. But the rabbit is part of the environment, you know, but the rabbit sort of like led me to the card that held the issue.
Okay.
And so it does definitely, according to this, describe your elevated position. She's a queen, so she has a certain amount of respect and experience and a solid base, both because of the earth and because of the stone throne. And yet, within all of that, she's not a haughty queen. She doesn't have attitude. You know, she has a softer feel to her. And her world consists of both her outer world and her inner world. And I'll stop there.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I could work with that. But I want to get Wald in here.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk to you about your bunny.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
There are four suits in tarot. And each one of the suits describes a different aspect of consciousness and activity in the human experience. One of the suits is involved with the energy and the activity and the focus and the intention that a person brings to their world. One of the suits deals with the heart and the issues of the heart in all sorts of ways, everything from trust and beauty and community and faith and trust. All of those things are connected together in that particular suit. There's a suit that deals with issues of the mind and all the issues of intellectualism, of thought, of system, of organization, of hierarchy, of connection, of measurement. And finally, there is a suit that deals with the substance of things, the hard facts, the clear evidence, the tangible world that we can all, you know, experience directly. And each one of those is symbolic and has all kinds of ramifications. So here you have a dream that consists of a series of things that have elements of those four suits. The bunny expresses an actor principle. The bunny is the actor. The bunny is the one with intent. The bunny is the one who knows what it's doing and mm-hmm. what it wants. The bunny has purpose. Even though a bunny is oftentimes seen as soft and cuddly, in this particular case, it is the actor principle. And the active principle in you has been invoked from the outset in this dream. You want something, you're headed for something, you're looking for something, you're going to get that something if you can possibly manage it. That comes under the heading of the suit of wands, which is the suit that describes both energy and focus. And it can take any form. In this case, it took the form of the bunny. Then there's the fact that the bunny itself is earth-colored, and that it's digging in the earth, that the earth is its medium. Whatever it's looking for can be found in the real world. It is itself a living creature who has significance over and above and beyond the physical and the factual. But what it's seeking for here, what it's looking for in your dream, is buried in the real world. And it's not easy to find. And it's not guaranteed that you'll find it, nor is it guaranteed what it is you'll dig up. But it's there somewhere. Instinctually, you know where to look. The third thing is, you had mentioned that it was covered with or included white bandages. But anyway, it included things having to do with your children. It included, therefore, issues of the heart. A touch, a hint, a suggestion that underneath all of this activity, there was something important that dealt with an issue of the heart, but it was out of sight and really not the main focus of your attention. So what we have here is an attempt to manifest something important, something hidden, and something that has a touch of the emotional from out of the practical facts of your current environment, using yourself as a soft but determined actor to uncover something hidden but necessary to find. So something is going on. There's something obviously necessary for you to do. You're under the imperative, the emotional and symbolic and active imperative to do something, to make something happen that needs to be done, to find something that needs to be found, and you need to do it fairly quickly. You don't know what that is.
A phrase that leaps out to me from what you were saying is a soft but determined actor. And I've kind of made a note of that to think about and come back to.
Right. So So it doesn't tell me precisely what your experience is. It doesn't tell me precisely what you're after or precisely what you'll find, only that you are experiencing internally a need to accomplish, a need to do something that requires your attention subconsciously that you have not yet really brought apparently to awareness. Something is going on inside you that's imperative. Something needs to be done. And it's something that if you're aware of it, if you're aware of the need, you'll probably find the details.
Well, something I want to think about, and it certainly opens up a lot of space for self-exploration and for potential dialogue if we had more time together.
Yeah, well, you have to remember that if we were actually sitting down together and doing a reading together, that this is only the beginning of a long exploration, and that mm-hmm. in the course of that exploration, the more specific applications of these particular principles would come into play, and you'd see rather rapidly something that was hidden from sight before.
Yes. Well, you know, I think we've come to the place where we kind of need to wind down. So I'm wondering if there's anything more that you'd like to leave our listeners with, anything maybe that you had planned to say that you didn't get to say, or...
Well, I don't know. Ruthann, do you have anything? All right, well, I'll tell you this. I think that the phrase that is so inimical to the psychological community, which is magical thinking, mm-hmm. as far as I understand it, magical thinking in the psychological context simply means foolishness, a form of believing that something is going to happen just because you want it to happen, regardless of what is actually going to happen. The facts of the world, the realities, are denied and replaced by wish fulfillment, and it doesn't get you anywhere. It's
right. I think that's accurate.
Et cetera. And in tarot, magical thinking involves the ability of a magician to do precisely what that bunny was doing, to take intentional action on any number of levels to accomplish a particular purpose. The whole idea of magic here is the application of will to the real world. So if you wanted to fly, for example, if you thought of it as a crazy person who gets up on top of a building and thinks that because they had a dream they could flap their wings and, you know, jump off a building and survive, that wouldn't work. But if you are Leonardo da Vinci and you had the idea that a human being could fly, you would work to the purpose of producing flight. And that intention, that desire to fly, which has been in human beings for a very long time, has manifested itself in the form of various forms of flight, everything from hang gliding to jet planes and rocket ships. It has, in fact, happened. It's happened by the dedicated intention of generations, maybe centuries full, of people who maintain the same intention. Intention by itself is the form by which magic takes its place in the world. Magical thinking is the thinking of an intent, forceful personality and intellect whose intention is to accomplish. Just like that bunny digging up something unknown, the human being has the power to intend. And that power to intend is the root of magical thinking from our point of view. And as far as I'm concerned, it is essentially the essence of what allows a human being to do all the things that have made human beings so remarkable in this world. Every ability of a human being to control his environment, to manage the world and himself, comes from essentially magical thinking, although they don't realize that that's what it is, and they don't call it that. And what tarot does is work with that and a number of other factors that make a human being human. And that ability to understand a human being as a human being, to know what it means to be human, is the essence of what tarot does and is, from my point of view. That's how I work with it.
And okay, well, that's a great place, I think, for us to wrap it up. And
sure.
This bunny needs to be digging along, so.
Okay.
No, I'm coughing. It's been great to speak with you both, and I want to thank you both for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'll see you before too long in New York City.
Great. We really look forward to seeing you there. And thanks again for having us.
I decided to title this show The Marriage of Psychology and Tarot, but I think it might have been better to call it The Marriage of Tarot and Psychotherapy. It should be obvious how easy it would be to continue with the help of either Ruth Ann or Wald to explore my associations to my dream image as well as to the Queen of Pentacles and all the rich imagery associated with it. If it were a truly mutual dialogue, it's not at all difficult to imagine it leading to the exploration of emotional issues that are both conscious or just below conscious awareness. I think in such a discussion, the boundaries between what is and is not psychotherapy become blurry. It probably depends quite a bit on what the participants are expecting, what they are intending, and how the encounter has been defined. And also skill and training, I should hasten to add. Of course, I knew that we would be doing this exercise prior to the time that I had the dream, so it's almost as if my unconscious were offering up a perfect tidbit for the exercise. But really, as in Alice in Wonderland, we could follow this rabbit hole down into the depths and discover a lot of fascinating and emotionally relevant material. The night before I had this dream, I was reading a book by an upcoming interviewee. The name of the book is What Aging Men Want. In it, the author uses the myth of Odysseus to take the reader through the important challenges of later life. And of course, the intended reader is the older male, such as myself. And even though I've only dipped my toe into the book's first couple of chapters, I noticed it was very effectively stirring up my inner waters, to say the least. I had noticed the night before that it had stimulated some very active and emotional-laden dreams, as well as causing me reflection during the day. By the way, here are the associations that I wrote in my dream journal after the dream that I shared. I wrote, the bunny's gift reminds me of the, quotes, sugar tits. Is that really the name we used? From when I was a kid, I remember I grew up in an African-American neighborhood, and I think this is maybe from a tradition from the South, but we would suck on sugar that was wrapped up in a piece of cloth, like an old piece of pillowcase or sheet, and we'd suck it for the sweetness, and because of the moisture over time, it would get really hard. I think wrapping tape around one, maybe white bandaging tape or black electrical tape to make a blackjack, a kind of weapon. It got very dirty looking after a while from playing with it outside. Now, yesterday I was exploring Google Street View and looking at the home where I grew up in my grandmother's house brought up reflections on time, mortality, and how structures tend to outlast us. And before bed, I was reading a book on what aging men want, and he writes evocatively about, quotes, the journey home. And also I recall my association that it, the bunny, reminds me of one of my children's stuffed bunnies that got very old and beat up looking over the years. Okay, so that's what I wrote in my journal. And if you go online and you do a search for rabbit as a symbol, you'll find a whole raft of potential meanings, some of the main ones relating to fertility, creativity, and new beginnings, and so on. And now it just occurs to me I have an association. I'm remembering that my grandparents raised rabbits on that property that I was looking at. Just now popped into my head. First of all, I'm tempted to see some synchronicity in the fact that my dream actually pulled a symbol from a tarot card. Now, since I do have some familiarity with tarot, we can't discount the possibility that my unconscious knew there was a rabbit on one of those cards. Consciously, though, I certainly would have not been able to tell you that. I had a hard enough time even finding the bunny, looking right at it once I was looking at the Queen of Pentacles card. But who knows how much we pick up subliminally. I do know that there's an image in the alchemical literature that I find particularly striking that I think has a blindfolded rabbit on it. I don't want to take the time to look it up right now, but I think I'm remembering it correctly. I like what Ruth Ann said about the card and the interesting fact that the queen is sitting on what looks like it could be a concrete or stone chair, which suggests to me a sound foundation, and at the same time that foundation is sitting on the ground, not in a building, which to me suggests firm grounding in the fundamentals, kind of amplifying that idea of having one's feet on the ground, so to speak. And that's a pretty good representation of me, I think. The queen's contemplating a pinnacle, a gold disc. And I'm embarrassed to confess this makes me think of money and how I'm always asking myself, as well as you listeners, as to whether I'm adequately compensated for this work. So clearly money is an emotional issue, a hot button, and the card gets me right into that. I especially resonate with Wald's line, referring to the bunny as, quotes, a soft but determined actor looking to find something hidden that needs to be found. You know, that could be a really good description of me. As well as his observation of my association with one of my children's old stuffed bunnies. So many avenues to explore open up here. Too many to do in this public arena. But I am the father of four and the grandfather of three. Plus there is my own inner child. So there's at least eight paths to explore right there. How about the fact that the hidden treasure was wrapped in bandaging? To me, that suggests the possibility of a hidden gift emerging from an old wound, something hidden away that needs to be dug up, unwrapped and reexamined, and that perhaps maybe has ripened or cured in its incubation underground. Going back to my exploration of Google Street View from the day before I had the dream, I was stimulated by a listener who wrote me that he was finding the exploration of strange cities using Street View to be an uplifting experience. So I thought I'd give it a little try, but I ended up going back to look at the house I grew up in L.A., as well as my grandparents' home, where I also spent much of my younger years in East Los Angeles. And both brought up a very strange brew of mixed feelings. Feelings of loss, nostalgia, bewilderment, a heightened sense of how objects and landscape outlast us, and on and on. Odysseus contemplating the journey home. Of course, none of this has anything to do with psychology, right?
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Adam from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a long-time listener for over 7 years, and finally I think it's time to back up my appreciation of Shrink Wrap Radio with a donation. You provide such a wonderful, stimulating podcast, and you deserve to have this supported financially by your loyal listeners like me. And you're right, donating to Shrink Wrap Radio made me feel great, so I encourage other listeners to donate and keep supporting your unique podcast. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thanks again, Adam, and I hope others will be inspired to follow in your footsteps. If you're helping to support this podcast through being a donor, how about sending me a brief audio clip saying what's motivated you, like Adam did? It's easy to do by calling our message machine at 206-350-9918 or using your computer or smartphone to create a sound file and emailing it to me as an attachment. By the way, it looks like the number of subscribers has gone up over the past year or so. It looks to me like our numbers may have doubled during that time. So thanks for subscribing. If you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio but have not clicked on the subscribe button on whatever software you're using, please do so. It costs nothing, and it helps me to know how many of you are out there. In fact, there is a place to subscribe on our site if you don't see a subscribe button on your software. You can do it on our site. It will help you to subscribe through iTunes. You might also fill out the listener survey on our site. You'll see a tab for it at the top of the homepage over on the right, and you'll receive a copy of a presentation on dreams I gave some years back in return. You should be receiving the March issue of our free newsletter soon. If you haven't signed up for our newsletter, there's a place to do that in the upper left-hand corner of our homepage. Thanks to listener Matthew in Croatia, we have a new transcript on the site. It's Shrink Wrap Radio number 336, The Neuroscience of Psychotherapy with Dr. Louis Cozzolino. I think that's a really important one, so thanks, Matthew.
Hi, this is New Mexico Jungian analyst Dr. Monica Wickman, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Dr. Monica Wickman, one of our favorite Jungian guests, will be back on the show next time. More about that in a bit. We're running a bit long once again, so I'll just take time to read one recent email from our listener community. And this one comes from Christopher, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for the interesting interview with McGilchrist. I also very much enjoyed your interview with Mark Solms. How can you manage all these diverse interviews in such an interesting and intelligent fashion?" I ask myself. It's my secret. He goes on to say, "Quite interesting was your discussion of language with him, as well as the corpus callosum and gender issue, parentheses, of which he is hesitant to talk about, close parentheses. I especially appreciated your question concerning the psychotherapeutic value of his approach. This talk of hemispheres is quite interesting, but to what practical/therapeutic use does it lead? And your summary, along with its caveat, was a fine service to the listener. Concerning the hemispheres, here is something from John Cutting's latest work. And in parentheses, he writes, the influence on McGilchrist by Cutting being at least as great as that of Louis Saas, both of whose writings on psychopathology and schizophrenia are quite interesting if you have a metaphysical bent, close parentheses. The only interview I know with Saas is from Madness Radio, by the way. And Saas is spelled S-A-S-S, Louis Saas. That's a name I wasn't familiar with. Going on with Christopher's email. And here, I just now realized upon rereading that Christopher is quoting Cutting. So it's Cutting who says the following. He says, McGilchrist's formulation of the way the two hemispheres conduct their business, and in particular the left hemisphere's sphere of influence, is quite different to how I see it. He views the advent of left hemispheric dominance in the human being over the course of human history, the bare fact of which I acknowledge, as a malign event, leading ultimately to our demise as a species, and interpretation which I contest. He attributes to the right hemisphere all the best things about the human being, including the spiritual sense, aesthetic appreciation, and even beauty. The left hemisphere, according to him, although originally an emissary of the right hemisphere's powerhouse, a view I agree with, is now, in the last few centuries, increasingly usurping its role and is responsible for the mechanistic, pragmatic, and dumbing-down Weltanschauung that we supposedly have today, an opinion I strongly disagree with. And that, I think, is the end of the quote by Cutting. And then Christopher closes by saying, thanks again, and keep on interviewing, Chris. Chris, I appreciate your taking time to write, and thanks for your appreciation of these interviews. I'm not sure what the basis of Cutting's disagreements with McGilchrist are. I did encourage you to post this in the comments area, so I would suggest you go back to the comments area and add the reference where you got that so that other people could look into it. So I think that better wrap it up for today. And in the interest of time, I will skip over the contact information. I'm sure you can figure it out. Thanks to today's guests, Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone, for their insights into the relationship of tarot and psychology. And as you heard earlier, my next show will feature return guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Monica Wickman, and she'll be talking about archetypal phenomena surrounding death. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.